once you get to certain stages to your business, what you did then is not what you do now. So he got to a stage where there were just too many numbers coming in and out. So he didn't really, he didn't know where he was losing his money. And that's when we came in and showed him, here's the areas that you're losing money and what to do to make those adjustments.
Hello and welcome to the Gross Profit Podcast. My name is James Kennedy. I'm the CEO and co-founder at ProcurementExpress.com. We take the hassle out of managing your company's spend with magical features, but we're not here to talk about that. Instead, I've got Aaron Daxet here to talk about how he has built his fractional CFO practice over the last 4 years. He's had significant success, and you're going to hear a little bit about some of the lessons he's learned along the way. Specifically, we have a good story about Mekalec, what we call in Europe, contractors or electrical contractors. We're going to get into how to incent them, profit shares, what maybe we can learn about this from, even if you don't use profit shares in your own industry, we're going to have a discussion around that. And then Aaron has somewhat, might say, a controversial business hero at the end. So we're going to stick around. If you stick around to the end, you'll figure out who that is, and we can find out who and why he likes this guy. So Aaron, thank you very much for coming on the show. Maybe you could just tell us a bit, the audience, a bit about yourself. If they haven't met you before, where are you in the world?
Yes. Hi, James. Aaron Mills, CEO of Daxet, located in Wisconsin, USA. Been in the construction industry for over 20 years. So excited to start my own company, Daxet, 4 years ago. And pleasure to meet you, James.
Yeah, very nice to meet you too. Sorry, I misnamed you there. Aaron Daxet is Aaron Mills. So sorry about that to start off with. So let me just ask about that. Daxet is the name of your firm. It stands out. You got a great domain name. Where did you get the idea for the name for your firm?
Yeah. So we were just like any business owner or company. We were just throwing out a whole bunch of different names. And we have a German Shepherd pet dog. And German Shepherds are known to be loyal and smart and a family dog. And hence the logo. And her name is Dax. And we're playing with the name Dax, and that just didn't seem right. And then all of a sudden we said, Daxet. And that's it.
Brilliant. I love it. Okay, cool. That's a good story because it fits, because often a good finance team or fractional team is like that German Shepherd, I guess, your loyal friend to help you achieve your goals. So it fits. It's very good. I like it. And I love the Daxet. I didn't see that coming. So that's cool. It's cool. I was expecting some sort of sci-fi reference, but now, okay, cool. Makes sense. So your 20 years in construction, has that been always working in finance, or how did you come into it?
So my education background is finance accounting. Started in the construction industry early in my career, actually right in 08, which was great. That's when the crisis in the U.S. happened. But the construction industry is just phenomenal people that are working hard and growing up from the middle class. And they have that middle class stigma of what it takes to be profitable in the mindset. So kind of showing business owners how to still be a great construction company, but also how to be profitable is really, really fun to do.
And it always seems to me like the construction industry, like there's big sums of money flying around oftentimes pretty quickly, you know, on any project pretty much. And I guess that's for good and ill. Like if it goes well, it can go well, but also you can do yourself a lot of damage because of the sums that are involved. And what area of the country are you in for a start? And what's the business vibe there?
So in the US, we are short of skilled labor. Uh-huh. And that's really our bottleneck, is now educating youth people that you could still make six figures in the construction industry. It is a career in the construction industry. And I think that's coming around now. You see a lot of people that were kind of, I wouldn't say the word forced or coerced, but when there was, everybody's got to get a degree. And that's the template of what everybody should do. Yeah. Has been kind of been the culture for the last probably three decades. And now that value, you see that students are getting in debt, not making money, not making great money, where in the construction industry, specifically, you know, in the USA, you learn on the job, plus you get paid for training. So you can make good money, not go in debt right out of high school. I mean, that's not a bad, that's a pretty good deal.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's two things going on, because that trend is also here in Europe, where I am in Ireland. We don't have the student debt issue, but also I think people are just starting to realize that everyone was told back in 2008 after the crash, go become a programmer. That was the advice I think Obama was giving out at that stage. And that's actually not right for everyone. And even in a college education, two things have happened. A lot of colleges have sprouted up. Just because it has a degree on the end of it as a name doesn't necessarily mean you're going to get a return on that investment. That's the financial side. But then I think, I don't know, part of me thinks like I'm not going to actually necessarily want my kids to go to college, even though my parents definitely wanted me to go. That was a big thing. How about you? What personally, is this good advice for everyone or just other people's kids?
Honestly, I believe everybody's different, right? So
right.
If somebody wants to be a teacher, ideally, you'd have to go to school to become a teacher. Now, if you like to work with your hands, or if you want to be more of an active type role in working, then sitting behind a desk 8 to 5 is not your job or not your ideal job. So, you know, specifically talking about the construction industry, I mean, you got to talk about like how we live these days. We're so reliable to construction, just our roadways, just how our houses work, at least, you know, skyscrapers. I mean, there's amazing projects out there all around the world that's in the construction industry. It's pretty cool, to be honest.
Yeah, and it's changing a lot. I had an interview with someone who was built 3D printing their houses. The technology has changed. That didn't actually work out so well for them, but that aside, it's not like it used to be. So what was your big, like, you came into the industry in a very tough time, 2008. So you're either learning or earning, as they say. So what did you learn most that you carry through to today? Because that was a very tough experience, I imagine.
Well, I mean, cash flow, that's got to be the most important. That's got to be one of the most important things in a business. There were so many construction companies that went out of business. And a lot of those factors were outside factors that you couldn't control, such as interest rates, banks stopped loaning money, the construction industry slowed down. And if you don't have cash or cash flow, you can't sustain even a bad project, which could be tomorrow. So cash flow.
Yeah. Okay. And I mean, there are just these beasts out there, animals who are just through force of will, make their business run, I guess, like who never looked at a balance sheet or a cash flow statement or did a month projection or anything. But they built up really significant businesses just through force of will. And it's got to be a bit of luck in there, I'm imagining. And I mean, this is, I think this is a client that you have had earlier on. You came across one of these, built up to several, was it tens of millions of dollars in income by the time you came along. And maybe you just tell us a bit about, this is a good case of how important cash flow is, I guess.
It was approximately about a $20 million electrical contractor. And they've built, by the time you get to that size, you have multiple project managers, and the business owner is more of the visionary and not hands-on. And they were struggling to the point of identifying when they were making money or bleeding money. And we came in and did an analysis, and this was, you know, right after COVID, and we had to start increasing pay increases to the employees, material increased, and the business owner was afraid to pass that on to the clients, a fear of not getting work. And we came in and we did our analysis and kind of explained to him that that's exactly what he needed to do to be profitable. Basically, he was break even. He lost a couple $100,000 prior to us coming in. And we finally got him to agree to the price increase. And he was kind of hesitant. So he even had us talk to his 5 other project managers and saying, hey, you know, we showed them the price increase and we showed them that the internal price increase. And then we had to, on new bids, new work, start to facilitate the new pricing for the clients. And everybody agreed to it. The other 5 project managers agreed to it. The business owner agreed to it. And anytime you do a price increase, I get a little bit concerned. So 10 times out of 10 so far, when we've done price increases, really, we've gotten almost zero kickback with when we do this with our clients. But to be specific with this client, we came back a quarter later, basically 3 months later, and we talked to the project managers and we went in the room one by one, said, hey, did you do the price increase? Project manager said, yes. We asked them, did you still get the jobs that you wanted to get? Project manager said, yes. And we just went down that line to each project manager and said, hey, did you do your price increase? Yes. Did you get the work? Yes. And and the other question we asked, did anybody kick back on any of the price increase? And the room also said unanimously that the client didn't even know that they did the price increase. So, So we went around the room and so the last person ironically was the business owner. And we asked him if he did the price increase and he said, no, he was scared because he didn't think he would get the work.
Right. And so two questions spring to mind there. One is, how did he get to tens of millions in revenue with the wrong pricing strategy? Had he previously had another finance team and they hadn't figured that out? Or was this the first time he'd sort of professionalized outside of his business?
There is some luck to it, right?
Right.
And I call it growing broke. Once you get to certain stages to your business, what you did then is not what you do now. So he got to a stage where there were just too many numbers coming in and out. So he didn't know where he was losing his money. And that's when we came in and showed him, here's the areas that you're losing money and what to do to make those adjustments.
Okay. So it was a classic, just doing enough volume that the bad ones are looking after the good ones, or vice versa, I guess. And true luck, a different set of years, different set of projects could have been different, but he made it that far and he made it out the other side. And then, I mean, you said you've done 10 of these price increases. That sounds very correct to me in that the owner is the one who's most bound up with the business, and a rejection of the business is a rejection of him. And maybe, I don't know, it goes back to his daddy or something. I don't know. I'm not a psychologist, but the owners are often the worst people because it's them that's getting rejected personally if someone says no. And just thinking about those other, it's interesting, you've introduced these 10 pricing increases and you've said that they've all, has it always worked? Like, hey, can you ever think, like, what's the worst thing that's happened when people have put up their prices?
So we've had good luck. We work with very good contractors and I, you know, it takes some coaching to go through some of this process as well as the data. So you always hear numbers don't lie. The other part is I believe you can compete on three things. You can compete on price, you can compete on quality, and you can compete on service. So most of these construction businesses that we work with, they have top quality or they have top service. So when you have top quality or top service and you try to compete on price, that's where you lose money.
Right. Okay. So I mean, my personal experience, I've seen this sometimes you go up market and then suddenly the customer changes and their expectation changes. So if you're able for that and you can cope with it, it goes well. But arguably, if you're not set up for it, it mightn't. So we all love our customers, of course. If anyone's listening here, I love you too as a customer and you're all equally valued to me. But like, have you been conscious? You say you have these great customers. Have you done anything to make sure that the customers you have are the right quality? Because I guess that also comes back on you, right? If there's not the quality, that also comes back. It's harder to work with them or something. Do you take that into account when you're onboarding someone? And what do you look out for in terms of a good customer?
Yeah, it's funny that you answer that question because I believe this is true in the construction industry too. So we take our sales process slowly and we get to know our business partners before we actually even talk about what a relationship looks like. And through that process, we even talk about our core values. We talk about their core values. We talk about what their goals are and we get in true alignment. So we build a relationship. We build a relationship before we even start doing business with them. And one of your questions is like, what do you look for? And probably the biggest thing that we look for is somebody that's willing to grow and is coachable as well. Because if you get somebody, and we did fire one client who fought tooth and nail on every suggestion and was not coachable. And We're like, hey, what got you here is not going to get you where you want to go. Mm-hmm. And those are the factors that we look for, is somebody that's coachable, somebody that wants to grow. If you don't want to be, if those are the areas you don't want to be, then you're not a right partner with us.
That's very interesting. It almost sounds like a sort of recruitment process. Like you look for values in your employees and you extend that out to customers. I mean, not most, sometimes you're in a pinch, especially in the early days, I guess, where you have any clients looking good. Have you walked away from sales processes? Like, it's all very well being able to say that when you've made it and you're doing well, but has there been a time where you broke that rule and then it didn't, how did it work out?
So, I mean, a lot of time there are times, so there will be clients that are not ready for us. And one of the things is we have a lot of people that we know that have other businesses that can support them. So if we're not the right fit, there are times where we'll bring in, say, hey, we know somebody else that would be better suited for you. So we're still there to help them. And maybe someday they would be a good fit. But inevitably, I believe if you do something good, you'll get something good in return. And that's just our philosophy.
So you have this sounds like a selective approach in finding the right clients, and yet you're experiencing significant growth. You want to tell us a bit about that, where you're looks like you're lined up at the end of 2024?
Yes. So we're 4 years into this, and 2024 has been our breakout year. We've added up to 8 employees now and have 14 clients. So our numbers aren't that massive yet, but we tripled in size this year, and we're looking to triple in size next year as well. And we're looking to get to 100 clients next year.
Wow. Okay. Interesting. So I want to ask you also about motivation in teams and what I would call a comp plan, but maybe you have a different, how do they describe it in the construction industry in terms of incentivizing teams with financial rewards?
To be honest, I think the construction industry is a little bit behind in comp plans and incentive employees. That's coming around. A couple factors that I think is very important is transparency. So a lot of times these business owners don't want to share, you know, how profitable they are or how profitable they are not. But once you do show some transparency, and you don't have to show numbers, one example I always use is I use a pie graph, and I kind of break it down into thirds. So one third goes to Uncle Sam taxes.
Yeah,
first. Yep. So you got to pay taxes. Another third goes to reinvesting in the company to grow it. Yeah. And then the third third goes back to the employees. And so now you're not really sharing details, but you're creating a vision for the employees saying, hey, my pie could be this big, it could be this big, or it could be this big. And with that bigger pie, what can you do for that?
And I guess that works great, especially whether it's in sales roles. But in construction, a lot of it is that the prices are fixed, I'm guessing, for a lot of contracts. I'm not sure how that works. But then it comes down to cost control, right? Because that's the biggest impact the guys on the job can have, if you like. So have you been able to get that far in terms of how do you, like the guys who are on the job just want to get their job done, move on? They don't really always necessarily, they might not know that it's important to get the right price and the right equipment from the right places. Have you any experience with encouraging that culture within a company? And how do you go about it?
Yeah, so a lot of time, or what we like to, again, it comes down to transparency. A lot of times what we want to do is being able to manage businesses on KPIs, key performance indicators. Yeah. So one of the easier KPIs, like you're talking about boots on the ground, is like, hey, I bid this job 1,000 hours. Every hour that we go under 1,000, $5 goes into a pot. That's just a generic example, but
right.
if you have that incentive, be like, hey, I get this job done quicker, I can get a bonus at the end of the job or at the end of the year.
Right. And then you need to set up the sort of quality control on the other side of that, right? So how do you go about that? Like, do you bonus someone else on the quality of that job, or are you just, is this come back to the values and you just got to believe people have a craft that they're working on?
You know, you're talking about, was there a warranty on the job? Another really important item that's not directly monetary is safety. Were there any near misses, or was there an accident on the job site? So those are other factors that you want to definitely track or make sure that is a priority within the business.
Okay. And how do you handle, let's say, introducing an incentive like that and it having unintended consequences, or it didn't work out the way you, because that's what I'm always afraid of. It's like the Christmas bonus. Let's say the first year you give it, you're a hero. Second year, if you don't give it, suddenly you're in the doghouse. So how do you handle people? You just become accustomed to these things, and if they don't get them, it's almost like a negative. I feel like if you give something once and then not another time, have you come across that?
And that becomes emotional for the business owner, and that goes back to transparency. So what I would recommend for that situation, just to prevent that situation, is to have quarterly meetings or quarterly updates so that, hey, when it comes to, you say, Christmas or December, like, wait a minute, I didn't get a bonus, or my bonus is half. You don't want it to be in December, whereas you'd be like, hey, March, be like, hey, guys, we're not performing where we're at. We got to make some tweaks to get to December, or at least they know in March. And then in June, you'd be like, hey, either we did or didn't make some tweaks. So again, that transparency and that expectation is set in those quarterly meetings.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So setting out the rules in advance, I guess, and making just not trying. So it's just perfectly clear. There's no surprises. I see this. We just had a quarterly meeting there and a lot of teams did really well, but we had a large customer leave actually. And that really had an impact on the business. And there was a disconnect between the team was like coming into the quarterly for a high five, and the finance guys were like, hold on, you don't realize that we did some things well, but, you know, and keeping that front of mind is tricky. And I feel that as a owner as well, like even just putting up the profit number there, it can feel very uncomfortable. It brings all sorts of sometimes guilt feelings, sometimes other feelings. But what my business partner says to me is, well, you know what? People don't look at it that way. Like they realize, okay, if you have equity in a business, it's just a different category. The team appreciate that trust. I feel like if you share financial details, that is a large piece of trust you're giving them. And that comes back. They realize that you don't have to do that. And there's a benefit there in terms of teamwork when you're upfront about how things are working, you know? So that's it. So you've had a lot of, it's interesting. I find that the often the things to talk about aren't necessarily the numbers, but the emotions in these things around putting up pricing or being transparent on money. Money is a funny topic. Like people get weirdly emotional about it in different ways. And that's something that's happened a lot. So let me just round it off here. I'm going to ask you who your business hero is in a second. But before we get to that, tell me a bit about, like, you've mentioned that you have your ideal client in mind, but who's the chef's kiss, like ideal customer that you could really add a lot of value to now? Is it all electrical firms, or what geography would they be in, and how would they recognize themselves if they were listening to this podcast?
Sure. So we're in the construction industry, and in the U.S., we work with skilled trades such as electrical, plumbers, millwrights, excavation, civil. So any of the skilled trades in the construction industry. And from a headcount, we usually deal with construction businesses between 50 to 200 employees. And really, the business owner, again, has to have that open mind that they want to grow their business, be profitable. We help business owners increase their profits. We help business owners, how do you exit your business? We even have business owners that wanted to exit their business, but we've created where the business runs itself. And now he's like, I'm only working one day out a week. So a lot of those business owners that just basically want to be open-minded, growth. And the other big thing is take care of your employees. Pretty much every business owner we work with, they do make more money and they share it with their employees. And it's pretty cool. It feels good.
Okay. So change of plan. This podcast is not over. I'm asking for a friend here. So you've helped someone transition to one day work a week. Tell me about the story there. Why were they able to do that when 99.9% of business owners can't manage to do that? And they, let's face it, a lot of people just get burnt out, run their business into the ground, and they hovel off, right? So, and the other thing is you hope someone comes along buys you, but how much control do I really have? But that sounds amazing. That sounds great. Oh, you have the choice to work in it, so you get all the benefit from owning it, but you're down to one day a week. What's your process there for helping people get to that stage?
Well, it doesn't happen overnight. The first thing we had to do is we had to get the business profitable. And that gave the business owner more confidence to make changes. And we started structuring the business. One, we broke the business into two different departments. We split it into a service department and a construction department. So now he's not managing the whole company. Eventually, we got a service manager and a construction manager. And then we also added another project manager. So here now we got three managers kind of doing what he was kind of doing. And like, that's really, really, really hard for somebody to think like, I can actually make more money with having three more managers, but now the company is more profitable. And instead of him working weekends and taking care of everything, he's got three other managers that are actually kind of divvying up his workload, and he's working one or two days a week.
So that's the thing that is hard to get your head around as an owner or a leader, which is, hold on, I'm doing this. We're hiring two people to do what I used to do, like at the weekend. And then, you know what I mean? Like, that sounds, and let's face it, these man owners sometimes have giant egos, and they're saying, well, we're hiring two people to do, or three people in that case to do what I used to do. And I bet you he thinks they're not even as good, maybe. So how do you get over that? How did you sell that vision? Because it's just very hard to do, to hire three people to do what I used to do. I mean, that sounds crazy on the face of it. What motivated this guy to get over that hump and just do it anyway?
It didn't happen overnight. What we did is, I would call them baby steps. Okay, so we restructured the service department, and that created a little bit more overhead. And then all of a sudden, the business owner kind of gotten relief and felt better. And actually, the business is actually running better now with it being separated. So it's baby steps, and then actually seeing that, hey, as a business owner, my life is actually getting better.
Yeah, okay. That sounds great. I mean, so maybe the lesson there is, you have to get over this idea that it's not going to be someone cheaper. It's going to cost more money to replace the work you used to do. And the other thing I heard there is, maybe you're not as good as you think you are. You think you're doing a great job, but actually these other guys can do pretty good. Guys and girls can do a pretty good job. And everyone has blind spots, I guess. And it's about getting around this. And then the third part is, I guess this is normal, right? For every business owner I have that would hear that would be, well, what if it all goes sideways, right? And the last thing I heard there was, you do it over time. You don't do it overnight. You bring them in, skill them up, build some confidence, step away a bit. And what's that guy doing with the other 4 days of the week? Do you have you any idea?
He's enjoying life. His wife's a lot happier too.
Yeah. Okay. Well, happy wife, happy life. Okay. Yeah. Now, you just said something there, which I wish more fractional CFOs led with, because that is the only way you can achieve that in your business, in my mind, purposefully, is to work with a fractional CFO. Like, yeah, you can say you want that, you can say whatever, but actually a fractional CFO is actually the one who paints the exact step-by-step picture on how to get there with all the numbers. So it's like taking a dream and just building a ladder straight up. And this is why, to be honest with you, I wish more fractional CFOs led with that as what they do. Like, if you lead with, I take your business and I just make it so you can make more money and make more one day a week. I mean, that sounds too good to be true, but then you've got the case study for it, right? So you're not blowing smoke. You can say, here's how it happened. This is the things, here's the challenges. And you can step someone through that because you've been through it. You don't have to do it for the first time. It's a very rare skill. What other hire can you make that could do that for you? I can't think of any. Amazing. I love that story. Okay. So, all right, let's get to it. I teased this controversial business hero that you have. So let's find out who he is and why, what you've learned from him.
Yeah. Grant Cardone. I mean, I just listened to some of his podcasts, read several of his books on behind the scenes. People don't realize this, but you know, he came from poverty. And he had to work his butt to get where he's at. And if you read some of his books, I related to him. So he's got a book that's called 10X and you have to go after it. He's got another book, Sell or Be Sold. It's a lot of it's about self-improving yourself, behind the scenes if you actually read the books.
So my take on him, and I know I haven't read the books, but my from afar it is, it's like Tony Robbins meets Donald Trump. I don't know if you can imagine that, but like it's like some sort of version in there. And what I really admire about that is, like we talked earlier about going to college and college education, all these things. I find like that stuff is not very self-empowering. Often people with that mindset of college mindset is like, well, the answer is out there and the problems are out there and it's sort of other things have to change or you have to use a tool or whatever. This self-improvement approach is basically all the answers are up to you, right? Which is absolutely 100% true. And it's like your ability to grow as a person is a function of your success. And that's a hard lesson to learn, but that, and I think that's why if you Google him, you see a lot of mixed fans and haters, I guess they call them. And that's because that's a hard message to actually take in. Like, yeah, actually, the problem is you. The problem is you're not working hard enough. The problem is you're just willing to do certain types of work and not others. And that's a hard, that's a bitter pill. A lot of people like to think that, well, I can just use my smarts or I can be cleverer than everyone else and I don't have to work the same way. Maybe they can, I don't know, but probably not. Probably they need to just work harder. And the great thing about that is that's very democratizing. Like, anyone can work harder than they're working today, like pretty much, right? Anyone can decide, I work harder than the next guy. So actually, I understand why people push against that. Like, I love Tony Robbins and all that sort of stuff as well. And I understand why people push against it. But, you know, I think it's, I'm with you on that one.
Thanks.
Okay, awesome. Well, this has been fun. Great little bonus episode there at the end there. I'm actually very fascinated. I think that's just so great. You've got that lived experience to walk through someone. If you are someone who likes the idea of having the option at least to work one day a week on your business or scale it up, and you want someone to walk alongside you in that process that's been there, so you're not doing it for the first time trying to figure it out for yourself, Aaron is a great guy to talk to about that. So thanks, Aaron, and thank you, listener, for getting this far. Your special benefit and bonus only available to you for coming this far in the podcast is you can go to procurementexpress.com/partners. I've just finished a webinar where I do my bit to kind of explain the power of hiring a fractional CFO. And I also have a case study from Ben de la Cretas. He's actually, his podcast is coming out first week in October 2024. So you can look back at this stage. So it's right now when I'm recording. And the case study with Ben is all about how he uses Procurement Express to put spend control in place for businesses that are not ready for an ERP yet. And that's his specialism. So if you're a fractional CFO or working in industry on a finance team, and that sounds like you're doing a lot of purchasing, and you don't want to buy an ERP, but you want to control costs, go to procurementexpress.com/partners and check out that webinar. Aaron, this has been a lot of fun. Thank you very much for coming on. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you, James. And likewise, it was a lot of fun. Thank you.